Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our weekly exploration of the cultures of we've talked about ayahuasca a bit earlier on this show, and it's really become one of the more hot areas of development of a new kind of culture of consciousness as this powerful psychoactive brew drifts out of the jungles of Arizona, where its knowledge was largely restricted to the natives and mestizos who live there, along with the occasional anthropologist, and is now almost a global phenomenon. Everywhere you go, you can find groups of people who are interested in this compound and in the shamanic ideas and experiences that surround it. But ayahuasca is not the only powerful South American psychoactive brew. It's kind of amazing. Ethnobotanists often remark on what an incredible concentration of powerful entheogens in South America, almost as if that part of the planet was chosen to be ground zero for psychoactive healing and wisdom. And one of the other traditions you find in South America with a different compound, in many ways a very different profile, but a very powerful one as well, surrounds the San Pedro cactus. And I'm very glad that today's show we're going to be talking with Matthew McGee, who is an expert on Pedro shamanism of South America. And but before I talk to him, I want to introduce Maja Dau. Maja, you were just telling me something about San Pedro.
I was. To me, the San Pedro cactus is a really interesting phenomenon in the world of hallucinogens. First, because it hasn't been put on any schedule, and you can actually purchase it at like Home Depot. And it's very widely available. And second, because a lot of people don't know about it. Everyone knows about peyote and, you know, mescaline and things like that. But this is actually another kind of cactus that carries a hallucinogenic compound, which does not, apparently, according to most people's experience, cause nausea and a lot of the kind of uncomfortable feelings that other cactus, hallucinogenic cactuses can give you. It doesn't have that kind of sickness that accompanies it. So it's kind of one of those, you know, under the radar cactus hallucinogens.
So I think we're going to bring on Matthew McGee now. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Well, I always like to start out and kind of talk, let people talk about how they sort of found themselves on their path. And what drew you initially to South America and to your interest in the shamanic practices there?
Well, I think in order to really do justice to that statement, I would almost have to trace it back to my early childhood. And in many ways, being raised within a culture that is, you know, lacking tradition or any kind of earth-based spiritual practice. And from my earliest years was having experiences that didn't really fit into the context of the everyday contemporary framework. And, you know, for most of my life, ended up having to live kind of in solitude and silence regarding these types of experiences, i.e., having the veil be thin and having experiences of the spirit world in ways that didn't really fit into the everyday conversations of others within my suburban lifestyle.
So those people who are simultaneously blessed and burdened with an unusual facility, an experience of these other realms that for a lot of people kind of are pretty far away from everyday experience.
Yeah, for me, the blessing didn't come until much later in life. For most of my youth, adolescence, and even young adult life, this was something I prayed to have go away rather than to see what kind of potential there existed within it. So it was definitely more of a curse for me than a blessing in my younger life. Something that I didn't really have a support system for, whereas if, you know, perhaps I was raised within the indigenous cultures of old, there would have been those other individuals in place within the society that had comparable experiences and could have led me through in some form of guidance. So as a result, you know, when you are 4 or 5 years old and you say that there's someone in my room with me, and your parents come in and they give you the pat on the head and the, everyone's scared of monsters under the bed type of talk, you kind of learn to, you know, silence and go inward. And as a result, this ended up leading me down the path of getting more lost than found until I ended up finding teachers that were able to bring me into a place of understanding and really allowing the whole process to be a co-creative one rather than the experience that I'd had prior to that, which was that of feeling victimized by things I didn't understand and couldn't control.
Well, and in you know, classic shamanic, anthropology texts and stories from shamans themselves, there's often this sort of shamanic illness that people go through, or a kind of, you know, we might even call it, in using contemporary language, a kind of, you know, psychotic break or a kind of breakdown of the conventional reality system, at the other end of which there's a sort of rebuilding. And did you go through something like that? I mean, it was sort of like, it was not just, the fact that nobody quite understood where you were coming from. It was quite a, intense sort of, confrontation with realms that most of us don't acknowledge, right?
Yeah, I mean, Joseph Campbell kind of says it best, you know, in that the mystic is someone who's somehow able to swim in the same waters that the psychotic drowns in. And, due to lack of guidance or inner resolve, I definitely did my fair share of drowning. And as I progressed, you know, kind of moving much further into the future where I actually had some guidance, there definitely was the classic shamanic death and dismemberment type of experiences. And in the sense of really needing to dismantle myself, and the whole process was more about unlearning everything I thought I knew than about, you know, apprenticeship and learning a specific set of rituals and rites within a tradition. And thankfully I was blessed with very good teachers along the way who were merciless in dismantling me and in many ways leaving no stone unturned, to the point where you are forced to confront the fears that you're facing and to really dissect all of the strengths and the weaknesses that we all hold within us. And the whole process of dismantling and leaving me in many ways as an empty vessel was able to take what I perceived as weaknesses in the past and has turned them into strengths. So in that way, there was liberation on the other side, yet it was a grueling process of death after death after death, metaphorically.
And that a lot of that happened, your first major teacher was still in the United States. It was before you kind of went to South America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a classic case of when the student is ready, the teachers appear. And my two teachers actually showed up within a month or two of each other, which was kind of extraordinary, because up until that point in my life, I had never even heard of the concept of shamanism or even metaphysics to a certain degree. And I was actually studying in my first undergrad degree to become an interpreter. And I had to go out there into the field and observe working interpreters, working with clients. And for this degree, I had to do a practicum. And that required 10 hours a week of, out there in the field. And my first placement was actually in an outpatient mental health clinic in Salem, Mass. And this is, you know, the first place that I met my teacher. And no, he was not a client. he actually was the site director of the facility. And I was sitting with my supervisor in the copy room and just having conversations, and she mentioned, oh, you know, there's a ghost that's up on the third floor, you know, and this, you know, is my alarm where I all of a sudden become tight-lipped and no, this is not a conversation I usually talk about. And she was nonchalant speaking about this spirit that's up on the third floor, and I was like, oh, you know, I've never been up on the third floor. I'm just kind of trying to pass off the conversation. And then my boss's boss walks in, the site director, this gentleman by the name of Ray. And she's like, oh, isn't that right, Ray? There's a spirit that's up on the third floor. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, everyone thinks her name is Eugene, but it's really Gladys. You know, I forget the names that he used. But it was the nonchalant way and comfort with which he spoke of this that kind of caused me to be curious. And so when my supervisor had to leave to go work, left in the copy room with this site director of a mental health facility, and I started asking him questions that he could only authentically answer if he had really had these types of experiences, you know, the way he said he did. And he was the first person in my life that not only was able to say, yeah, I've had these experiences, oh, and has this happened to you yet, and has this happened to you? So it was like finally meeting kindred spirit, and as a result, I kind of wore away a path to his doorstep. And over the next few months, he was teaching me about world religions and shamanism. And, you know, as a sidebar, at the same time that this was happening, I was only getting 7 hours of practicum experience through the outpatient clinic and had to supplement those hours through sporadic events around the area. And I was sent to go attend a weekend gathering called the Hummingbirds Rise. And I was like, oh, great, you know, I have to sit for a weekend, you know, listening about birds. And when I arrived, it was not about birds at all. And it was this gentleman from Peru who was here and teaching about the tradition of curanderismo, which revolves around a altar-like arrangement of sacred items and a very rich tradition that dates back thousands and thousands of years, again, in tune with the sacred dimensions of life, including the spiritual presences that are always in our midst. And so kind of at the same time, these two people just kind of showed up in my life right at a point where I had just about given up. I had kind of reached my last, I was on my last legs, so to speak. And they were able to kind of allow that collapse to finish and then were able to help me restructure my life in a way that fit with a new paradigm, inclusive of the vast array of you know, spiritual presences and energies that exist as subtle forces within our midst.
Well, this is what's so interesting about your experience. I mean, so quintessential, and just the way that the shamanic experience happens is that at first it's extremely isolating, right? That you get, like, separated. I mean, it's just basically the alchemical experience, the whole process, where you get separated from everyone and feel like you're not even part of the world. And then it goes around in a circle, which actually connects you to the source of everything. And, like, you know, you said you meet these people, and then you find out that there is actually this tradition that exists and other people have had this happen to them. And then in that way, you kind of have a mystical experience where you're opened up to everything, but it seems like it can only happen through that very specific isolation and death and dismemberment period. And it seems like it can't even exist until you go through that kind of break apart isolation. And then you can be like re-released into the world. And I was just curious if, you know, through when you were experiencing all those things when you were younger, you said you were on your last legs when you met these, you know, two folks that then kind of drew you back into connection with everything. Were you, when you met them, able to start really putting those pieces together, or did it take time for you to readjust to that, or was it just totally overwhelming?
I think probably a mixture of all of the above. I went in very, very skeptical. You know, before I handed over my soul to be reworked and reconstituted by anyone, I wanted to make sure that these people were authentic and legitimate and had done their work. But at this point, I was really, you know, despite being very skeptical, I was also, to a certain degree, very desperate for this information. I had gone through very solid periods, you know, just to kind of press rewind a little bit, because it's a very complex evolution of trying to find a way to understand these more abstract concepts on my own. And the path, you know, for better or for worse, led me towards the path of entheogens, which seems to be the topic of our conversation. And initially, probably around the age of 14, I realized at a very early age that if I, you know, consumed massive amounts of alcohol, I could pass out in the evening and not have to deal with those type of things that occurred in the in my nighttime experience. Because for me, my everyday ritual, unfortunately, was running up to bed once it was time to go to sleep, hoping that the spirits wouldn't follow me this time, and then basically praying myself to sleep every night. Mm. And at 14, I realized, well, hey, if I just drink a bunch of beer, it's going to put me right to sleep. I don't have to deal with that stuff. And, you know, what I didn't realize at the time was that these experiences were happening all the time, yet during the day I could stay very distracted. You know, the cars are going by, I can go play, birds are chirping, yet every evening all of these distractions would subside. So I started self-medicating at a very early age, and alcohol led to using cannabis. And cannabis ended up leading to saying, well, if this works, well, maybe I should try some, you know, psilocybin cubensis or LSD. And what started off as a great potential as a teacher, i.e. as an entheogen that's starting to teach within, ended up becoming disastrous because of my lack of a guide. And what basically happened was I was venturing too far, too fast into these non-ordinary states of consciousness and really not leaving myself any semblance of a breadcrumb trail. And I spent so much time there that I literally lost contact with the collective experience of reality, in the sense that I was able to be functional, yet I was not able to have that same type of connection that we all share when we're dialoguing and so on and so forth. And, you know, to really give the abridged snapshot version, this led me to a place literally of an attempted suicide. And from that place of being at about as low as you can go, about as far as you can go with still being able to come back, it was shortly after this that my teacher showed up in my life. So in some ways it required a massive surrender before I was even ready and open to trying to transform this in my life. And then finally meeting these teachers, again, fast forward into that place of that encounter. It was a healthy dose of skepticism, yeah, but at the same time, a very lengthy process, not only of trust, but of acclimating to this new system. To give you an idea of what it took, after a year of what I thought was apprenticeship, my teacher finally sat down with me and said, okay, I will now commence the formal apprenticeship that you've been looking for. And I was like, well, what have we been doing for a year? And he's like, well, I needed to make sure that you had sustainability. And after that sustainability was established, then we began. And that's when things really started. If they weren't challenging before, they became inordinately challenging, in the sense of I couldn't hide anymore in any way, shape, or form. And it was a 24-hour apprenticeship, no breaks. I had to finish school, quit my job, and I was on the living room floor of this wise man's home for about 5 years. I thought it was only going to take a few months, but apparently I'm a slow learner.
can you give us a sense of what his background was? When you describe this, I mean, I'm sure it was very unique to the situation, but also just where did this guy come from? Was he a Christian? Was he working with spiritualism?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and one I think I'm still trying to answer myself. He's one of these anomalies where the only way I could really describe it is that he comes from a cross-cultural shamanic background. If you had to tie it to any one specific tradition, it would be actually the nomadic Bedouin tribes of the Middle East, yet expressed through a more contemporary form of Christianity or Roman Catholicism. Yet I hesitate to even say that because the manner in which he articulates himself is not wedded or bound by any tradition. It's more of a universal type of life teaching rather than being bound to any one specific tradition, lineage, or religion.
Well, it's fascinating also because in light of your later studies in South America, it kind of sets you up for the kind of syncretistic approach, you know, in a way, like from the very beginning, you're living in suburban America and you're seeing ghosts, and then you're encountering these teachers who don't even come from anything you can put your head on. You're not even sure what's going on. And in some sense, it was the ideal set up for what you find when you go to South America, and you discover that there too, even though there are very, very, very deep, long, ancient traditions that are inside of that are all throughout the area, that they also take this form of using what's useful, and if there's that involves Christianity, use some Christianity. If it involves some spiritualism, use some spiritualism. So it's fascinating how much that's been in part of your story all the way through. But what brought you to South America after this long apprenticeship?
Yeah, actually, the South American venture actually happened while this apprenticeship was taking place. It was almost, in many ways, a simultaneous apprenticeship. As I mentioned earlier, my practicum ended up having me meet two teachers within a few months of each other. And I see the wisdom in spirit's guidance, at least in this direction, because the Peruvian tradition, which I haven't really spoken of yet, provided an incredibly important aspect of my own process, in the sense that my apprenticeship with Ray in Boston was much more of an inner process. It was almost, to a certain degree, like a very intense form of psychotherapy, but extending beyond the typical spectrum of what that encompasses. In contrast, the Peruvian tradition, which I apprenticed in as well simultaneously, was with a gentleman by the name of Don Oscar Ramiro Quesada from Lima. And through our mutual friendship and dialogue, he also kind of took me under his wing and began a bit more of a formal apprenticeship within the lineage and the tradition and the history and the cosmology and mythology of the tradition, which revolves around a central altar, which is basically comprised of various items known as artes and cuyas and setcas and conopos and so on and so forth, which are essentially just physical pieces of spiritual import that are holding medicine, for lack of better descriptive terms, and having something that was concrete and tangible.
Did your teacher, were you like one of the only kind of white people that he had accepted, or was that like normal for him to kind of accept outsiders into the teachings?
Yeah, for me, I was one of many white people. Part of when my teacher ended up completing his two formal apprenticeships down in South America through the Pakokuna lineage of the southeastern Andean regions, and also of the Huachuma lineage of the northern coast with his two teachers, he was commissioned to come to the States. And this is it's also part of the prophecy of their tradition, the coming of the Taripai Pacha, they call it, the age of re-encounter, where the people of the South are going to need to connect with the indigenous people of the North, and there's going to be an exchange of information, of teachings, of wisdom. So upon the formal completion of my teacher, Don Oscar's apprenticeship, he was commissioned to come up to the States. So when I had met him, he had been teaching up here, I think, for about 8 or 9 years before I encountered him.
And I want to get across to people also just the beauty and wonder of this, the mesa or the altar that you are describing. I mean, usually even if we have a good sense of how amazing altars can be, there's something particularly, it almost seems like a sort of archaic control panel of some sort of, interdimensional craft, the meticulousness with which each individual shaman will create their own, version of this, and yet there are these repeated elements as well. People in front of their computers can go on and see. There's a few images online that I've dug up, but it's really a remarkable and distinct part of this particular tradition, is its relationship to these small objects and the way in which they hold and shift energy. So if you could talk more about how that works, that would be really great, because it seems to be one of the more unique things about the tradition.
Sure. It's one of those challenges when, usually when I teach, it's there presented as a visual, yet articulating it in more of a didactic might be a bit of a challenge, yet I'll do my best. Essentially, the tradition that I apprenticed in is an oral lineage. So rather than having a written history, the history of the tradition, its understanding of its cosmology and mythology, and even its form of healing artistry, is really passed down from teacher to student through the aesthetic arrangement of medicine pieces. And these can either be passed down from the teacher you're apprenticing with, or they can be found. Oftentimes they're constructed on your own, carved. Yet each of these pieces has all of these levels and layers of symbolism of its historical and cosmological and mythological. Yet the more important piece of this is that these pieces end up becoming an externalization of your inner process. So to a certain degree, the artistic arrangement in which they're presented is like your diary, so to speak. So experiences that you had that were powerful or transformational, epiphanies that took place in your life, even the hardships that have transpired as a result of your unfolding, these concepts, energies, are anchored within these apparently inanimate objects. And in addition to that, they're also woven and connected to certain places of power within the tradition, i.e. specific mountains or lagoons or certain forests that have spiritual import within the tradition. And when you take all of these layers and levels of symbolism and allow them to start working together, they create almost like a working vocabulary to have a direct communication with spirit. And not only a direct communication in the sense that you're able to put forth prayers for more powerful manifestation, but you're also able to then listen and to receive guidance through them. So that comes into play only once you really understand and have a semblance of mastery in regards to how the dichotomy of the mace is set up. Am I here with you still?
Oh, that's wonderful stuff. You know, I want to go into more about your healing apprentice, but I think we're going to take a brief break right now. And so this is Eric Davis. We're listening to Expanding Mind, and we're talking with Matthew McGee, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Mitchell J. Raven to tell you that we have two new time slots. Every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society, with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Raven as together we create a better world.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible to the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm doing a new show here on PRN every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Turning Point. What will we talk about? Well, everything, from birth to death and most things in between. I'll be using stories in the news and personal observations from my own life. And from time to time, I'll be taking your calls. So please join me, Mike Fader, every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point on PRN.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Progressive Radio Network. We're here with Eric Davis, myself, Maja Daou, and our guest, Matthew McGee, talking about shamanism. And Matthew, can you tell us a little bit about the San Pedro cactus? I know for me it's an interesting entheogen because, like Eric mentioned at the beginning of the show, most folks know a lot about ayahuasca and some of the more celebrity entheogens, but San Pedro is kind of one of those unsung heroes of the entheogenic world that I became kind of fascinated with because a friend of mine brought me some cuttings of one, and I had never heard about it before, so I started researching it and was just amazed at what I found out about it. Can you maybe talk about how you were introduced to it and, you know, some of the tradition behind it?
Sure. I would say that if any one thing is responsible for the evolution of the tradition, it would be this cactus, at least in the northern coastal Wachuma lineage. It has been used for thousands and thousands of years. I think the latest archaeological evidence is over 3,000 years through the mochi pottery and through the ceremonial depictions of its use within ceremony in the shamanic culture of the northern coast. And from my dialogue with my teachers and observations of these ceremonies in the Peruvian heartland, it becomes very evident how the entheogen itself is in many ways the catalyst to awaken all of the dormant potentials that exist within the human spirit, and in many ways allows the augmentation of the senses to exist to a certain degree of being able to diagnose illness and also to have the remedy for the delivery of medicine on a shamanic level to heal any of the various spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical conditions that are present within the client. And I think as a result of that, it's become the most important piece, I would say, within the tradition of Wachuma Curanderismo on the northern coast.
Hmm. How is the spirit of the plant conceived? I mean, that in ayahuasca traditions, one often encounters this idea of the plant as a spirit of the forest or as the tree of the of departed souls. People often speak of ayahuasca as a female spirit. I'm curious whether in the tradition as you encountered that there's a kind of personification of San Pedro. Is there a sense of it as a distinct kind of presence, or does it have a more general medicinal kind of framework?
I mean, the first connotation, especially within the more contemporary version of it, i.e. the blending of the Spanish influence, Roman Catholicism. I mean, the reason it's called San Pedro is because St. Peter is the Catholic saint that is known to hold the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And as a result, the San Pedro, the cactus, and the medicine that once embodied in many ways has the ability to unlock those doors that oftentimes are impassable without the catalyst and are able to thin the veil enough to see beyond our ordinary semblance of what's going on and to see what's happening behind the scenes within the elements of the sacred dimensions of life. It does have a bit more of a masculine connotation, and this might be in part because of the cultural context of the machismo in the northern coast. Yet, I have heard that it is a very universal, user-friendly type of medicine in comparison to, say, something like ayahuasca, which is far more dramatic and harder to hold the reins of, so to speak.
Well, they have actually in traditional medicine found that it has like antibiotic effects against some of the like super bacteria, like the staph bacteria that are penicillin resistant. They can actually use San Pedro to treat it. So it does have like kind of, even though ayahuasca is used medicinally, this one definitely has more like, you know, medicinal uses, like even for heart disease or high blood pressure and things like that.
Yeah, it has uses even as far as being utilized as a shampoo, a daily shampoo within the culture. So yeah, its applications are very vast.
Yeah, I think it's also good to point out that one of the ways that it differs from ayahuasca is that there's in general two main categories for psychedelics or for entheogens, the tryptamines and the phenethylamines. And tryptamines include psilocybin and DMT, which is active in ayahuasca. But the San Pedro, the most active alkaloids, are mescaline, which is a phenethylamine, which is the family of mescaline, and also MDMA. So it's a different family of psychoactive powers. But what also just interests me is the fact that it's a cactus. I mean, just the presence of the cactus itself, and the fact that, as Maja pointed out, you can buy them at Home Depot, and that they're sort of around. There's this kind of character that the cactus has that really it just seems kind of remarkable. When you were apprenticing, how much did you sort of learn about the plant itself and how it works and where to find it and how it's cultivated and that kind of material?
Very little in regards to the actual chemical components of the plant. The people that I learned from would never have reduced it to a simple component of mescaline. They see it very deeply as a living, breathing, very wise entity, and that this plant itself has a spirit, and it's the encounter with the spirit and the communion with the spirit, almost in the form of what could be like a Eucharistic encounter. Mm-hmm. That interaction between those two things is where the attention is focused, and I've never heard it be reduced to a simple chemical before, at least within the tradition.
And then you mentioned Eucharist. That strikes me as also because how Christian are these traditions now? Like, in some sense, yes, they're using Catholicism because Catholicism is in the neighborhood and it's a good idea to make the priest see that you're doing something Catholic. But is there a deeper kind of esoteric sense in which there's something profoundly Christian or Catholic about it in your experience?
Yeah, I think in the beginning it was definitely out of need, with the whole Spanish conquest in the 1500s, and Pizarro and his conquest for gold came also the oppressive religion of Catholicism. And in the beginning, any overt practice of the pre-Columbian shamanic practices were, in many ways punishable by death. So part of what I've fallen in love with about this tradition is the wisdom behind it, in the sense that the Peruvian people, with their tradition, understood that the externalized form of something was far less important than the underlying intention. So they were able to, in many ways, adapt to the oppressive religion in the beginning in very creative ways. So, their earth-based spiritual practice, which had profound import on, say, the mountains or the lakes or the lagoons and so on and so forth, they found very clever ways of, at first saying, oh, well, we can't pray to that mountain anymore, so let's name that mountain Aputayasa Jesu Cristo. We'll name that one Christ, and we'll name this one St. Michael, and we'll name this one St. Francis. And then they could overtly pray aloud by having the names of the mountains be associated overtly with Christian iconography and ideology, yet underneath they would be really praying to their mountains, and the same would be done, instead of doing the Arinti Daimi, they would just, move the ceremony a few days later and do it on the feast day of St. John the Baptist, and they would carry the effigies of the Catholic saints, but they would always hide their mummified Incas inside the effigies. So in the beginning, they found very creative ways to, in many ways, preserve the core tenets of their tradition, but allowed the form to become much more fluid. And over time, fast forwarding in many ways to contemporary times, you're going to find a very strong presence existing today within almost all forms of the Northern Coastal Shamanic practice in a syncretic blend of pre-Columbian cosmology and Spanish informal Catholicism. And in today's world, they were able to, over time, start in many ways separating the religion from the tradition and they saw great strength in someone, say, like St. Francis of Assisi, who's depicted with animals covering him and, you know, has an affinity for nature. And they're like, oh, well, St. Francis has, you know, a connection with the animals. We can weave him in. And, you know, the examples of Christ and his powers of healing and connection to the, you know, one spirit that exists within all things, well, that we resonate with as well. So over time, it really became one expression of the same faith. And today's society, you'll see, it's inseparable in many ways, unless you go out into the far more remote regions of the southeastern regions. In those practices in the Pakokuna lineage, you're going to find the rare tradition that is untainted by, say, the Spanish influence Roman Catholicism, but it is much more rare.
How much do those traditions differ in terms of the way that the ritual healings look? Are they almost distinct?
Yeah, they're definitely very different. The consistent factor, though, is that there is a ritual bundle or a mesa that is incorporated within the healing practice. Yet in the southeastern Andean regions, these mesas are called tawantin mesas and are much smaller, and usually they stay bundled. You'll never see, or very, very rarely will you ever see, the artifacts that are held within. And the bundles themselves are utilized as almost a whole medicine object that's utilized for healing. And a big part of their practice, in a more overt sense, is the creation of what's known as despachos or haiwarikuis, which are consecrated offerings that are comprised of various plant, animal, mineral, and human-made objects that are aesthetically arranged on a piece of paper and then either burnt or buried as an offering. And there's over 200 forms of these ceremonies within that tradition, and that's more of their overt practice in healing, as opposed to the northern coastal tradition, where their mesas are always unbundled. And typically, the healing ceremonies done in this tradition in the northern coast are done in the evenings, so from sundown to sunup. And oftentimes, the practitioners never allowed their mesas to see the light of day. Yet they are open and exposed as far as their ceremonial pieces are concerned. So there's, you know, slight variations, yet the cosmology and the mythology shares a great similarity between the two, despite its difference in expression.
Well, it's interesting, too, because in Catholicism, right, they have the relics that are hidden within the altars, which is kind of similar, right? They're usually bones or, you know, pieces of clothing or parts of the saint that then they, like, hide within a dark little box that doesn't, you know, get taken out, and it's hidden inside of the altar. So that's actually similar as well.
Yeah, I mean, and in many ways, there's a connection with that statement as well. I mean, the relic that's in place within the altar on the Catholic and the Catholic churches is called the mensa, and the Latin term mensa, which is why, you know, the Catholic Church, if it's the Church of St. Michael or if it's the Church of St. Francis, you would have a relic of that saint embedded within the altar. And part of the origin of the name mesa comes from that Latin mensa, which is metaphorical of the spirit embedded within the inanimate that exists as an expression of your connection with divinity. And the mesa is definitely one of those things.
So we can see that there's this transformative process where different cultural situations come along and the tradition transforms while staying true to its healing essence and to its relationship with these powers and presences. How is it changing now? I mean, one thing that comes up, you know, if you're looking at, to take the other major example we've been talking about ayahuasca in the Amazon, is that the whole culture of ayahuasca, both in the Amazon and, of course, in the rest of the globe, is changing drastically. But in the Amazon, even among practitioners, lineages are being challenged. The whole idea of who is a shaman and who is brewing the material, it's all been, not all, but a lot of it has been very, very strongly transformed by the interest of Westerners going down there, and it's really becoming almost a different kind of culture to some degree. I mean, obviously, there's still going to be deep traditions that are hard to tap into. But the kind of healing practices we're talking about have a different framework. They have a different relationship to the West. But how are things changing now? I mean, how is this message and these practices carrying forward in the 21st century?
Yeah, it's a challenging one to answer. I mean, in the same sense that, you know, shamanism in many ways has become this misnomer. You know, it's been used as a term to kind of describe a vast array of these spiritual phenomenon. When, you know, originally the term was utilized to describe one specific tribe in Siberia and Central Asia, the Tungus people, you know, yet it's become this misnomer. And I think in contemporary society, just as a direct result of us having access to so much information now, whereas all this stuff was once exclusive to the apprentices of tradition, all of a sudden there is an exponential growth in how much of this information is becoming accessible to the you know, average aspirant within even, you know, obviously suburbia. So there is inherent risk in that, in the sense that it is definitely becoming watered down. And a lot of the new age spiritual practitioners out there are, you know, in many ways like, oh, I like this piece of the Native North American tradition, and oh, I like that, and oh, this piece of the South American, and oh, this piece of the Tibetan, and they're trying to throw, in many ways, all of these individual concepts into one large melting pot. And the risk in that is that it's almost, you know, the equivalent of going out there and learning, say, 5 words of Japanese and 5 words of German and 5 words of Russian, and then trying to have a depth conversation with anyone. You're going to be sabotaging the process before it begins. So part of what I encourage, at least in my own practice, is that any one of these love-based spiritual practices is going to have a complete system, and it's necessary in many ways to dive into that system and learn it as much as you can in its entirety, i.e. have your language base established as a solid foundation, and then you can build upon it with, you know, and supplement it, you know, like say, you know, even once you know what the word dog means in English, you can say, okay, perro, that goes right on top of that, and I know where it goes. So one of the risks that I'm seeing as it's evolving within the mainstream culture is that people are just taking what they like and then they're discarding the things that they don't like. And there's some risk in that.
It's also risky because people find out that they can make money by setting up these ayahuasca taking groups, right? So they charge an exorbitant fees to just basically give people ayahuasca with no guidance whatsoever. So, I mean, then you're talking about no language at all, where they're just like predatorily taking advantage of the fact that people want a shamanic experience.
Right. Yeah, and the hard part is that, you know, like within our, at least the Western culture, we're so lacking of the ceremonies that connect us with the sacred dimensions of life that we will grab at anything because our spirits are starving for it. We're very hungry. And the problem is, unless you have taken the time and the effort and the energy to really allow yourself to dissolve and you have taken an aggressive account of who you are as a person on, you know, all of the messy parts, you know, and the strengths and the weaknesses. And if you're moving out there into a leadership position, especially when entheogens are being served, you can end up causing far more harm than good within those settings. It's a very dangerous arena to venture into if you're not prepared. So, you know, I encourage everyone to be very discerning if they travel down to Peru with knowing their teachers, you know, or any other place for that matter.
What is it that you, when people express interest in shamanic healing these days and the people you encounter, what do you feel like they're, how much good can this stuff do for people before they've done the kind of harder, messier work that you talk about? Is it really more about people who are stepping into leadership roles, or does it in a certain sense apply to a lot of people that we, you know, that we come from this very consumerist, kind of narcissistic, privileged frame of mind, and even if we find ourselves very unhappy and unsatisfied with that, with our world and spiritually hungry, that sometimes our attraction to these, even our initial positive attraction to these traditions, maybe should be questioned a bit because there's stuff that we're not getting even just to get in the front door, so to speak. What's your sense when you as you've seen people who are interested in this stuff or learning it alongside you, et cetera?
I think it's very challenging, especially in the States, because our concept of these type of entheogens always ends up falling into the recreational capacity, because we don't really have the same depth and reverence that you'd find in, say, the indigenous cultures that have been utilizing this plant ally as a teacher since time immemorial. And because we don't really have a concept of that, at least most of us don't, you do find a lot of people in walking the red road that are looking for more of a recreational experience. And in that sense, I, for most of the last 14 years of teaching in this arena, I am always discouraging people from going down the road of finding some entheogen, because when it really comes down to it, the pet spirit, even though it's a very powerful ally, is simply the catalyst to unlock the dormant potential that exists within the human spirit. And there are many, many roads that lead towards that destination, including the path where a catalyst is not necessary, i.e. diving into who you are as a person, you know, and finding out what's going on the inside. And through that, through the Mesa tradition and through curanderismo, there's a way of leading a person to that goal without the need for an entheogen as its catalyst. So there's many ways to get to the same destination, in other words, especially within, you know, the framework of the United States, where communion with these types of plants is against the law. So my primary work has been in doing this kind of interaction without the need for any mind-altering substance to be the agent that implements the transformation.
Well, you were talking to earlier, you've been sort of aware or experiencing presences since you were a little kid. I'm curious, after all the time you've spent with different practices and reading and, you know, getting older and all the things, how would you come to characterize, what's your personal cosmology in terms of how these unseen presences or powers relate with our conventional world, the world that you know, all of us kind of recognize and deal with on a daily basis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say that I am forever in a process of a working hypothesis in regards to how I interpret it all. It's almost like with new information, this thing can change. And the more I've grown in understanding about how the spiritual path is and the realization that it's all essentially mystery, there really isn't any way for me to know wholly whether these spiritual presences that I encountered in my youth were actual deities that were engaging in my own process of consciousness, or if they're, you know, maybe some sort of externalization of a fragmented aspect of my personality. I mean, and when it really comes down to it, there's no way of discerning which is which. I think it just depends on how you choose to situate your vision. And from within this work, I would say perspective is probably one of the most powerful agents of how you allow your life to unfold. So I would say, if anything, I've learned that I know very little about what's really going on behind the scenes. Yet, despite knowing very little, I've learned enough to be able to participate and enjoy the ride and be an active observer. And with that, new information, new concepts, new epiphanies, and shifting paradigms is pretty much a constant within my life. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it also seems that in that quest for a larger perspective, that you haven't, I don't get the sense that you sort of turned your back on what we would think of as a sort of realistic, skeptical, even skeptical frame of mind entirely. Like, in my experience, I meet a lot of people who are on spiritual paths, some whether or not they're involved with entheogens or not almost doesn't matter, and I get a sense often from people where they see the way that skepticism or a sort of ordinary critical frame of mind can sort of turn off the very thing that they want, and so they abandon it. And that often seems very dangerous to me, and also oftentimes not as interesting. But I get a sense from you that there's still that there's a place for that kind of questioning and unwillingness to just sort of hold on to a spiritualist or supernatural explanation or to know what the spirits mean necessarily, what they ultimately are. Was that something that you came through on your own, or was it actually part of the way that you've been taught from your various teachers to keep that kind of edge?
Yeah, I would say this is something that's probably become part of my own process of spiritual growth and development. And, you know, I think everything can be tied to the wisdom of the tradition and teachings. You know, in essence, the core aspect of both of my apprenticeships was really about stretching me in many ways, even if I ripped and tore. So it's about really being able to hold the polarities, you know, to hold the light and the dark, to hold the positive and the negative, the creative and destructive forces that exist within us. And that includes, the skeptic and the believer and, within me. So part of what my path has led me to in its current expression and my current working hypothesis, so to speak, is about being able to hold the two polarities and to find the place in between those two extremes as far as the spectrum is concerned.
Do you feel have you ever had moments where you felt like you were actually able to do that?
Yeah, it's kind of a tightrope walk. I would say that the moments are becoming more frequent as I mature within the path, but they've been more sporadic in the past.
Because, that what you're describing, that's the mysterium conjunctio, right? That's unification of the opposites. That's like the meat and potatoes of every mystical tradition.
Sure.
And so, just to be able to tell people that that is something that you can experience and that you can kind of get access to, that's a pretty big, heavy thing, right? Even though, as you say, it's not easy. It's that climbing the ladder of razor blades type of thing. But I mean, to be able to actually ensue a practice that would enable something like being able to hold polarities, I mean, it's good to know that there are people experiencing it like you've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, my teacher described it, in a contemporary sense, is that it's not really that complicated. You know, it's almost like if you were ever a little kid and you played in an above-ground swimming pool, you know, those large circular above-ground swimming pools, and he described it as, he's like, life's kind of like that. And, I was like, okay, you're going to need to elaborate because that doesn't make sense. But the way he described it was, he's like, you can only play in there so long before you eventually come across this, game of running around in a circle and creating a current, And with that current, you can kind of lift your feet up and the current kind of moves along in that circular path. And he said, and in that way, life is kind of like that. We're born into the world and everyone's kind of walking in a certain direction and they're all creating this current and energy. And as a default, you just kind of follow suit, and at first you start following that path. And then at some point, for better or for worse, you wake up and realize, well, why is everyone walking this way? I don't see the point in it, and I don't see the benefit in it. So you turn around and start trying to walk against the current. And in addition to fighting the current, you're also fighting against the people that are moving in that direction. And he said this fight, that the struggle goes on ad nauseum, ad infinitum, until you finally learn how to surrender in a healthy way. And through that surrender, the currents themselves just naturally draw you to the center. And within that center is the still point of the revolving wheel, where the power of the currents are not influencing or affecting you anymore. And it's from within the place that you can observe the extremes, the people fighting against the current, the people creating it. And from that still point, you're able to hold the polarities but be unaffected by them. And that's really the middle path, or the campo medio that's spoken about within the Peruvian lineage. And there's definitely teachings that can assist you in discovering that on your own.
Well, that is a sweet image to end this conversation. The next time I go swimming in the pool, I will never forget that it, too, can serve as a model to encourage me to find the middle way in my own life. Matthew McGee, thank you so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind. It's been a wonderful, fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate your willingness to open up and give us a really rich view of your life, your experience. It's been wonderful.
Thanks very much. It was great to be part of it. Thanks
All
for
right.
having me.
Well, Great. I'm Eric Davis. For me and Maja Daou, you've been listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your minds open.